This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
Okay, well, thank you to NSA and Policy Review for inviting me to speak today, and thank you all for braving your way through the snow to get here. It seems like an extremely long while ago now, but in June, you know, back in the days when it was sunny, I provided an opening to an NSA conference on higher education futures, and I was asked to speak on how I believed the higher education policy would develop over the next 12 months and beyond. In the course of this presentation, I commented, and I'll put the quote up on the screen, that I thought that the coalition government, the new coalition government, would push forward with a system of credit accumulation and transfer, break down barriers between full-time and part-time study, raise the status of further education, encourage private providers to enter the marketplace, and genuinely provide access to a form of higher education for all, literally at the end of every street. In a 15-minute presentation, you must admit that my eight words on private providers was not a major focus. Imagine my surprise then when I left the studio and received a call from the Daily Politics inviting me on to discuss my controversial remarks, and which were being run on the BBC online as a story, Private Universities to Expand to Fill Places Gap. A university leader is forecasting an expansion in private universities as students face a shortage of places. And when the OECD picked up on the story and ran it globally, I'm forced to admit I was astonished at the power of my eight little words. I feel it only fair, then, that today I provide you with another 1,992 words to actually explain what the 1994 group and I personally believe is the role of private providers in the future of the higher education system. And I thank Policy Review again, once again, for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you and kick off what I think is an extremely interesting and challenging agenda today. So what is my position on private providers? Right. As John has said, the impact of the growing number of private providers in higher education is, I believe, an incredibly complex area. I believe that the term private provision should be regarded as an umbrella term under which a whole host of activity operates. Private providers can be both partners and competitors to leading universities, indeed all universities. In either case, there are significant benefits for students, our universities, and the wider HE sector. Okay, first I'm going to turn to private providers as competitors. Since June, not a week seems to have gone by without press coverage of the expansion of private providers into higher education. In this context, the private providers are almost exclusively regarded as competitors, and here my position is simple. Where private providers are delivering excellent student support and student satisfaction, this poses a challenge to the traditional universities to continue to enhance their student experience. This challenge is good for students and a good way to enhance quality and standards. As John has said, private providers, most notably the University of Buckingham, I can trot that one out as well, have existed within the UK landscape for many years. These providers have generally been small, focused institutions providing access to mainly professional qualifications. The rules for governing their access to government funding are complex. Those institutions which have sought and gained degree awarding powers are awarded them on a heavily conditional basis for a limited period, as opposed to the lifetime award to the traditional universities. In these circumstances, private provision has remained a small and specialised niche activity. In the last year, however, two factors have shifted the dynamics greatly in favour of the rapid expansion of the private providers. The growth of for-profit higher education in the US has significantly changed the nature and structure of the American HE system. Once disparaged, they have become significant challenges to conventional US higher education by offering accelerated degree programs online or near where students live, at night and at the weekends. These universities and colleges have collectively increased their share of the market from 2 to 10% in just a decade. The University of Phoenix alone has 443,000 students, 26,000 faculty members, and a market value nearing $10 billion. In its last financial year, the university's owner, the publicly traded Apollo Group, earned $4 billion, a 27% increase over the previous year. And like in the UK, students at these for-profit providers have access to federal tuition loan schemes. Earlier this year, alarmed at the uncontrolled growth of this provision, the US Congress undertook a number of hearings into their activities. Commenting in the Times Higher in September, Alan Ryan, visiting professor of politics at Princeton, summed up the criticisms levelled by Congress in three points. I've got them here. First, traditional academics think they inspire a race to the bottom in academic standards and salaries. Second, it is said that they recruit students on a false prospectus. By claiming their degrees will result in higher earnings, they induce students to sign up on for a degree and take out loans to pay for it, but do not deliver what they promise. The well-paid jobs are not there, so students end up with large debts and low incomes. Finally, these institutions get 90% of their income from publicly funded loans to students, and the default rate is enormous. Their students take out 7% of all student loans and have 44% of the defaults. The institutions keep the money, but the students are liable for the debts, no matter what job they get. The potential for reaching saturation point in their expansion within the US market, along with the likelihood that congressional pressure will reduce access to federal loans, has obviously encouraged the for-profits to look overseas for opportunities to expand their activity. Here, England has simple attractions. They see a government that is sympathetic, and there is strong potential demand. 1 month into the formation of the coalition government, it was announced that the for-profit BPP College of Professional Studies, owned like the University of Phoenix by the Apollo Group, had become the first private provider to be awarded the university college title for more than 30 years. Commenting, Minister for Universities David Willett said, "It is healthy to have a vibrant private sector working alongside our more traditional universities. International experience shows a diverse range of higher education providers helps widen access, focuses attention on teaching quality, and promotes innovative learning methods, such as web-based learning." In addition to an ideological attraction to the increased role of private provision, the coalition faces a simple problem to which the private providers provide an apparently simple solution. The attractiveness of the English HE system to UK and EU citizens has created a hugely disproportionate, unaffordable demand for places, with UCAS reporting 2 weeks ago that over 200,000 applicants had been unable to find a place in the 2010 admission cycle. Within an extremely constrained funding environment, encouraging private providers to enter the market potentially enables the government to deal with this overdemand problem without increasing costs to the taxpayer. The details of the government's proposals in this area will be included in the white paper to follow in March of 2011. But to me, it looks as if there is one giant sticking point. As we've seen in the US, one key feature underpinning the expansion of the for-profits has been access to federal student support. It is assumed that part of the quid pro quo of an attempt to balance supply and demand will be that private providers will be provided access to the newly enhanced student support arrangements. However, the finance of such a significant expansion, potentially significant expansion, of an extremely expensive and generous student support package simply don't add up. In its analysis of the government's HE funding proposals, HEPI concluded that the RAB charge, the cost of the student support subsidy accounted by the Treasury, would increase from circa 30%, i.e. it costs the Treasury 30p to lend every £1 of student support, to circa 50% under the new model. BIS and the Treasury disputes this number, but with the average fee more than doubling and the student support system proposals making it more generous than the current system, even if the RAB charge remains at 30%, this represents a significant additional cost to the Treasury. Put simply, this means that the reduction of £2.5 billion in teaching grant announced in the CSR will be used to largely subsidise the cost of the enhanced student support system. I'm not sure that this is what the Treasury intended. What it does mean, however, is there is little or zero headroom to expand student numbers. Indeed, one doomsday scenario put to me is that if the government pushes ahead with expanding access for the student support arrangements to private providers, it cannot afford to do this without reducing the number of students accessing student support within the traditional universities, all of which does nothing to solve a supply and demand problem. If you add to this problems regarding the conditions attached to the award of degree awarding powers, it suggests that the market conditions for private providers are not attractive as they might initially appear. We await the recommendations of the white paper in this area, but in advance of that, it's interesting to note that in late November, it was reported that more than a quarter of the purchase value of the for-profit provider BPP has been written off by its US parent company because of uncertainty surrounding the UK higher education market's future. Yet, the focus of competition marks masks the complexity of the relationship with higher education. For in the majority of cases, private providers are important partners rather than competitors. It is here, I believe, that there are the greatest opportunities for the significant expansion of private provision. Let me give you a few examples. Since 2006, INTU University Partnerships have successfully launched 10 joint venture partnerships for international students, 8 in the UK and 2 in the US, including 1994 group members Exeter and East Anglia. The joint ventures provide pre-degree programmes of academic and language study. Students have first-class, custom-built, on-campus teaching and residential facilities. October 2008 saw the opening of a new £38 million study centre at the University of East Anglia, managed and wholly financed by INTU, with over 420 beds and 30,000 square feet of teaching space. An investment of £48 million at the University of Exeter is leading to the development of a similar centre. INTU students are recognised students of the university with access to all of its facilities and have the chance to engage with their future academic degree programmes. The universities have retained full control of academic quality and its own brand. INTU supply the student recruitment network and manage the venture. The centres directly recruit academic staff while adhering to the high-quality standards of the university partner. The success of these joint ventures can be measured in numbers. At UEA, at the time of launching the partnership, there were fewer than 50 international students enrolled on academic preparation programmes with 13 full-time staff. Today, there are 136 full-time staff and 700 students. Exeter has been similarly impressive with its results, increasing staff numbers from 20 to 81 and increasing student numbers from 30 to 600. 65% of these INTU Exeter students progress directly onto university programmes. You'll hear later from Stephen Healy about more about the work that INTU is doing. Similarly, a rival private provider, Study Group, has established a network of 12 international study centres, including once the 94 Group, at Lancaster, Leicester, Surrey and Sussex, providing specialist on-campus degree preparation, including highly personal academic monitoring and support for international students at both undergraduate and postgraduate level. Further, working directly with its academic partners, the INTU model has evolved to embrace innovative new opportunities, including projects for gifted and talented students and the establishment of branch campuses. And again, you'll have an opportunity to hear later from Professor Edward Acton, Vice-Chancellor of UEA, regarding their partnership with INTU to establish UEA London. Another model is offered by University Partnerships Programme, UPP, and again you'll hear from Sean O'Shea later today, and I hope I'm not stealing his thunder when I say that since 1998, UPP has been working with an expanding range of university partners, including within the 1994 group, Exeter, Lancaster, Loughborough, Reading and York, to supply risk-free solutions for the funding, design, build and operation of high-quality academic and residential facilities. These range from new developments through to estate transfers and the refurbishment of existing premises. Schemes are delivered at no cost to the university, at specifications developed in close consultation with student users, are financed on a non-recourse basis, and at the end of the lease are handed back to the institution in their entirety. For example, the 963-bed eco residence at Lancaster University opened in 2009 and is the last phase of an existing partnership agreement between the university and UPP dating back to 2003. The largest accommodation project in the higher education sector, UPP's work with Lancaster University has delivered 4,347 rooms over three phases with an investment of £180 million. UPP has already invested almost £1 billion in the higher education sector, and supported by Barclays Capital, plan to invest a further £1 billion. The aim of the company is to provide strategic options that allow universities to better meet their immediate and long-term financial commitments. By removing from the equation funding that would otherwise be tied to student accommodation, universities are free to invest in other facilities. Put simply, and these are my words, not theirs, why spend taxpayer money on capital development when it's possible to develop a joint venture and use private capital to achieve the same benefits at a potentially higher efficiency and standard? Now, the development of these relationships is not simple and clearly can create uncertainty amongst faculty and administrators who might find it difficult to deal with the realities of this new, more market-oriented environment. This is where true partnership rather than outsourcing, seeks to provide a bridge in the provision of services between the traditional university and the private provider on a mutually beneficial basis. In each of these cases, a strategic decision has been taken that working in partnership rather than the university acting on its own is the best way of delivering what the students need. And to leave you with a final thought on this topic, whilst the examples I have provided have been ones where strong traditional universities have joined with private providers to achieve their strategic aims, at the opposite, you know, most extreme end of partnership, it is of course possible to see a practical scenario where this mutually beneficial relationship extends to the private provider protecting the best interests of students by effectively taking over a failing institution. Indeed, it is here that the for-profits might find their market opportunity. So, to conclude, was I wrong when I foresaw that the government should encourage private providers to enter the system? No, I believe I was not. But whilst my 8 words have pretty much proven to be correct, difficult for them to not be, hopefully my 1,992 words this morning have exposed the complexity behind this simple statement. There is a government drive towards the expansion of private providers, but it remains unclear whether in a complex policy and constrained fiscal environment, the for-profits will find market conditions favourable to expand their activity to a sufficient scale to generate genuine competition with the large traditional universities. However, whilst the eyes of the press and politicians have been focused elsewhere, a whole range of private providers have established flourishing and growing mutually beneficial partnerships with HEIs, which have needed little encouragement and little government intervention. I suspect that ultimately, it is in collaboration with the traditional universities that the private providers will ultimately find the most long-term sustainable success. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the conference today.